Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of All Crime No Cattle, one of your favorite Texas true crime podcasts. And this is episode 53. It is an Aaron episode. I'm Shay, aka Detective Shay Butter, aka Dork Nowitzki. And across from me is the Bone Lady. What do you got for us, Bone Lady?
Well, we've had a bit of a break.
We have. It was kind of an impromptu hiatus, but now you have these wonderful dulcet tones of Aaron and Shay once again, so I'm sure you're happy.
Yeah, and it's time to get down to business, and I, for one, am happy to announce that this case is going to be a bit of a breather. We've covered some really troubling, upsetting cases recently, and although those stories are incredibly important and need to be told, it's also nice to have a case that we can actually have a little more fun with. And so this is it for us on this day.
Well, I, for one, am very excited about a fun episode that's not heavy on the murder, which I don't believe this one is, right?
There is absolutely no murder.
Oh, hey.
Maybe right. Attempted murder, but no actual murder.
Excellent.
Yes. Well, let's go ahead and get our sources out of the way. Our first source for this episode is the Talking Points memo article from June 2013 entitled How Investigators Unraveled the Latest Ricin Case by Hunter Walker, an article by Manny Fernandez for the New York Times published in May of 2013, another article for the New York Times published in July of 2013 by Ron Nixon. I also used several different court documents, including the criminal complaint and appeals documents. And then finally, the Investigation Discovery TV show called Who the Bleep Did I Marry?
Wait, that's what it's called?
Mm-hmm. And this was season 6, episode 10, entitled Poison Love.
That's the best they could come up with. Who the bleep did I marry?
It's one of those cheesy, yes, absolutely. It's one of those super cheesy, like, reenactment type. Yeah. Well, this case takes place in the small town of New Boston, Texas. New Boston is located in the far northeastern corner of Texas, about 22 miles east of Texarkana, so very close to the Arkansas border. The town of Boston was originally named after a storekeeper named W.J. Boston, who lived in the area during the settlement of the late 1800s. When a railroad depot was constructed 4 miles to the north of Boston, a town rapidly grew around it. The town was named New Boston, and Boston became Old Boston. Then a county courthouse was constructed between New Boston and Old Boston, and the post office named this location Boston. So there is a Boston, an Old Boston, and a New Boston in this small area of Bowie County, Texas.
Really?
Yeah.
Still to this day?
To this day. And fun fact, according to the Census Bureau, New Boston has a total area of 3.3 square miles and less than 5,000 residents. Guess how many churches the town has according to its website?
I don't know. A lot?
It's a lot. Do you just want to throw a number out there?
25.
28.
Whoa.
28. So, you know, that's not excessive. Let's just say if you are a Catholic, a Pentecost, or a Baptist, you have all of the options in the world if you choose to move to New Boston. So now let's zoom out for a more macro view of the geography of this case, because this story really begins in the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., and in New York City, when three threatening letters laced with the toxin ricin were sent to three prominent politicians back in May of 2013. All letters appeared almost identical with typed mailing labels and no return addresses. The first letter was addressed to President Barack Obama at the White House. The letter stated in part, quote, "You will have to kill me and my family before you get my guns. Anyone wants to come to my house will get shot in the face. I served in the United States Army, and because your Muslim ass will probably never be able to retire, I will have to work until I take my last breath. I deserve better, and so do my wife and kiddos. I will take care of this myself and make sure you won't be running this country into the ground any further. What's in this letter is nothing compared to what I've got in store for you, Mr. President."
Okay.
We're starting off strong.
There's a lot going on in that message there.
The second letter was sent to New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Bloomberg was a proponent of stricter gun laws, and back in 2006, Bloomberg co-founded and largely financed the nonprofit group Mayors Against Illegal Guns. This organization is now called Every Town for Gun Safety. This group has promoted passing universal background checks and laws prohibiting people with domestic violence charges from owning firearms. According to their website, their mission statement is to, quote, support efforts to educate policymakers as well as the press and the public about the consequences of gun violence and promote efforts to keep guns out of the hands of criminals. From 2011 to 2014, the director of Mayors Against Illegal Guns was a man named Michael Glaze. The third letter was sent to him.
All right, we're seeing a theme here.
Mm-hmm. The letters sent to Michael Bloomberg and Michael Glaze were almost identical to each other and were a variation on the pro-gun rhetoric. Quote, you will have to kill me and my family before you get my guns. Anyone wants to come to my house will get shot in the face. The right to bear arms is my constitutional, God-given right, and I will exercise that right till the day I die. What's in the letter is nothing compared to what I've got planned for you. The letters to the president and Mayor Bloomberg were discovered early in their normal screening processes and were opened under controlled settings and were later transferred to the care of the FBI. However, Michael Glaze actually opened his letter and personally discovered the ricin inside before notifying the Washington, D.C. Police Department.
Oh my gosh.
Which is absolutely terrible. Like, well, he was walking out of his office, opening this letter, and then realized, I'm sure he didn't know what it was immediately, but realized it was something.
Oh, yeah. If, like, some mysterious powder just falls out of an envelope.
Exactly. And you're like, oh, God, what was I just exposed to?
Yeah.
So let's have another little science corner and talk about ricin. Now, when I mention ricin, what is the first thing that comes to mind?
Immediately, it's a deadly powdery substance that all I know about is how people reacted to it in Breaking Bad.
That's exactly right. I think that that is true of most of us. When we think of ricin, we think of Breaking Bad.
Yeah, and I think it's made from a seed. I don't know.
Well, we're going to talk about that. Okay. But as far as this possible connection to Breaking Bad, put a pin in that because we're going to come back to that very end of the story. Yes. So what is ricin? Ricin is a highly toxic lectin found in the seeds of the castor plant, scientific name Ricinus communis. They are often called castor beans, and they look just like beans. They look like little dried pinto beans, maybe a little bit darker in appearance, but they are actually seeds. Now, the seeds themselves are coated in a skin that isn't digestible, so theoretically, you could pop a handful of castor seeds, and as long as the skin is still intact, you'd be fine. Again, theoretically, I wouldn't be trying it out, but yeah, you're probably okay. You would have to actually chew up the seeds and swallow them in order for the ricin to enter your system. About 8 seeds, chewed and swallowed, would be dangerous. Maybe not enough to kill you necessarily, but you'd get really, really sick.
Yeah.
To really get a potent amount of ricin out of castor seeds, you have to filter out the ricin to get a concentrated dose. And it turns out that's pretty easy to do by creating a slurry of the castor beans and filtering it with water and other substances in a process called chromatography.
Chromatography? That sounds like a study of colors.
Mm.
Okay. Well, that's scary that it's so simple to do.
Oh, yeah. Apparently, this process is pretty easy, and recipes for making ricin are easily obtainable online, or so I'm told.
Great.
Now, I didn't double check this because I figure I'm on enough watch lists for all the horrible stuff that I Google for this podcast.
You didn't Google how to make ricin?
No, I did not. But from what I've heard, finding out exactly how to make ricin is only a search engine away.
Well, you know, we're putting a podcast out about ricin, so that puts us right on the list anyway. You might as well have Googled it.
You're probably right. But ricin can be made into a powder, a mist, or a solution you can dissolve in liquids. Pure ricin is a white powder, like you mentioned earlier, and if you inhale an amount equal in size to a few grains of salt, that is enough to kill an adult.
Oh, that's so terrifying.
Yeah. So once ricin has been introduced into the body, it enters the body's cells and prevents them from synthesizing proteins. Without being able to synthesize proteins, the affected cells will begin to die. Ingestion of ricin causes major issues in the gastrointestinal system, including inflammation and hemorrhaging, nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. If ricin is inhaled, it can cause coughing, fever, pulmonary edema, seizures, and respiratory failure. So basically, it just tears through your body, kills your cells, causes widespread organ failure. It's a nasty, nasty poison, and it's extremely dangerous.
That is so scary.
There is no antidote for ricin poisoning available yet, although that is being worked on. And no real treatment exists either, besides just managing the symptoms. So your ability to survive depends on how you were exposed and how potent the ricin you were exposed to was. Now, if you compare ricin to a few other biological toxins, such as anthrax or botulinum, it's not quite as dangerous. And in fact, although it was studied during World War I and World War II to find out its potential use as a weaponized agent, it was kind of passed over in favor of other chemical and biological agents. It's not economical or efficient in killing in massive amounts of people.
Oh, but if you need like a targeted person, it yes. might be a good tool.
Yeah, absolutely. The real deal with ricin, though, is that the castor plant is super common and that ricin is so easily refined from it. Castor plants are commonly grown all over the world. They're easy to cultivate if you really want one. You can order the seeds online. And they're not going anywhere because castor oil is a very important byproduct to use in a ton of different products. So, basically, ricin is this incredibly dangerous toxic poison that is easily refined from a plant that you might be able to find growing in your neighborhood.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Now, the ricin found inside these particular letters, luckily, was not the super potent powder that denotes a highly processed version of the toxin. Instead, it was a weird, greasy, orange-tinted substance found kind of smeared on the pages inside the envelopes. Lab testing would confirm that the ricin was of a relatively low strength.
So the person that did this didn't do a very good job.
Yes.
And why was it greasy? That's weird.
I mean, I think it just depends on exactly what process they used and how they did it.
We're dealing with someone who's not very good at writing a letter to these people because, man, there's a lot of issues in that letter. But then B, they're not very good at their attack, the making of the ricin.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Okay.
But they still did attempt to send a very toxic
compound. Oh, yeah, they're still a dangerous person.
Yeah, exactly. So now the FBI has three letters laced with ricin that have been sent to three political figures, including the President of the United States. So obviously this is a serious matter. None of the letters had return addresses, but all three had been postmarked in Shreveport, Louisiana on May 20th, 2013. However, this facility handles mail from Louisiana, Texas, and Arkansas, so that didn't really narrow down their search. That's when the FBI tapped into the Mail Isolation Control and Tracking Program, or MICT program, used by the United States Postal Service. The MICT program is an imaging database that photographs the exterior of every piece of mail that is sent in the United States. Now, the program is used by the Postal Service to help sort mail, but it can also be used by law enforcement to track mail.
Mm.
So in this case, they isolated the images of the three letters, then looked at the images of the mail that had been photographed immediately before and immediately after those letters to see the return addresses on all of those pieces of mail. And that's how they were able to narrow down the ricin-contaminated letters to New Boston, Texas.
Ah, okay. That's really smart.
Well, I'm about to make it not so smart.
Oh, okay. I don't know who this person is, but...
It sounds really smart, but I'm about to make it sound really scary. The reason why this is important, this MICT program, is because before this case, the Mail Isolation Control and Tracking Program was not known to the public. The reason why we know about the MICT program today is the FBI acknowledged the program in the criminal complaint from this case. Now, what got people in a tizzy about MICT is it's essentially a way for the government and law enforcement to spy on people in a mass surveillance system with virtually no oversight. A judge does not need to sign off on this. The agency just has to fill out a form. According to the New York Times, former FBI agent James J. Wettick said that MICT is, quote, a treasure trove of information. Looking at just the outside of letters and other mail, I can tell who you bank with, who you communicate with, all kinds of useful information that gives investigators leads that they can then follow up on with a subpoena. It can be easily abused because it's so easy to use.
Okay, so to understand what you're saying, this is something that is a really important tool that could be very useful in a situation like this, but there might not be enough oversight or layers of protection for private citizens with this particular mail sorting technological service. Is that right?
Yeah, and it can be used to track what everyday citizens are doing, who they're contacting,
right,
who they're banking with, who they are sending mail to and from. And again, the response to the critiques of that program is that it's for the safety of the American people. But it's just like a lot of programs and a lot of things that have happened in the country, especially since 9/11, where it's how much of your privacy are you willing to give up in order for that air of being protected?
Is this a relatively new software that had come out like during right before this time period, or had it been used for a while?
That's the thing. The program was actually instituted back in 2001. Do you remember back around that time when letters laced with anthrax were sent through the mail and they ended up killing 5 people?
Yes, I do remember that.
Well, that's when this program was instituted.
Okay.
So from 2001 until 2013, when this case happened, this program was being utilized without the knowledge of the general public until this case brought it to light.
Interesting.
Now, spokespeople have said that, again, it's for the safety of the American people, and this information is only kept for a short period of time before being destroyed. But we kind of just have to take the government's word on it, don't we?
Yeah, that is kind of scary that they could pull anyone's mail and check out what's going on there. It is interesting. I could see how that could be a very useful tool, but also a dangerous tool in the wrong hands.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially considering this was a program that was not known to the public. This was completely under wraps.
Yeah.
This mass surveillance system.
It seems like something you should be above board on, you know, if you're going to be using it.
Yeah. Well, because of the MICT program, the FBI was able to narrow the search for the person responsible for the letters to New Boston, Texas, or the surrounding area. But it turns out that they really didn't even need to go through the trouble, because on May 30th, a woman named Shannon Guess Richardson, who lived in Boston, Texas, came forward with information pointing towards her husband as a possible suspect in the case. Shannon had had a tough life, but she thought it was all behind her when she met her husband, Nathan. She'd endured abuse at the hands of her ex-husband, she'd suffered terrible health issues, including brain aneurysms, and she'd been recently diagnosed with brain cancer. She had 5 children, and she was about 4 months pregnant with her 6th child, and she didn't even know if she would survive her pregnancy. And recently, she'd noticed some very strange behaviors from her husband, Nathan Richardson. Nathan was an Army veteran, and remember the letter to Obama that mentioned that the sender had served in the Army?
Mm-hmm.
Well, recently, Shannon said he'd been increasingly angrier. He'd become abusive to both her and her children, and he'd become more violent in his political views. Shannon told the FBI that Nathan was very racist and hated Obama and was spouting extreme political views about gun rights and Muslims. But it wasn't just Nathan's words and behaviors that had begun to terrify Shannon. Over the past months, Shannon believed he was trying to poison her by slipping something into her food or drink. This fear led Shannon to start poking around to see if she could find anything as concrete proof. When searching Nathan's computer, she found internet searches about ricin.
Wow, was he trying to poison her with ricin?
Well, that's kind of what she thought at the time.
Oh, man.
She also said that she found a post-it note in Nathan's office with the names and mailing addresses of President Obama, Mayor Bloomberg, and the organization Mayors Against Illegal Guns. Shannon told the investigators that she had discovered suspicious items like Tupperware containers, solvents, and other supplies that could be used in the making of ricin, and she had found a, quote, suspicious-looking substance in the refrigerator. She said she didn't really piece all of this together, however, until she had heard the news stories about the ricin-laced letters and realized that her husband must be involved.
That's crazy, man. Could you imagine if you just found out that I was making anthrax or ricin or something? That's very shocking. What do you do in that situation?
I'd turn your ass in too.
Well, yeah, but man, it's got to be just a really eyes wide open moment.
Yeah. Well, she was smart, too. She wasn't just relying on investigators believing her only based on her words. She actually brought with her items that she believed would prove Nathan's direct involvement with the letters. She handed over a book of stamps she had found in their house.
Oh, awesome.
Testing would prove that the stamps on the three letters all came from that exact booklet.
Oh, good for her. Yeah. Man, she must have been watching some ID channel.
Oh, I know, right? Well, with all of this information in hand, the FBI went to Nathan's place of employment to detain him and bring him in for questioning. He worked at the Red River Army Depot located between New Boston and Texarkana. This is a facility used today primarily to repair military vehicles. If it rings a bell, 17-year-old Pollyann Moore, one of the victims of the Texarkana Phantom Killer, also worked at the Red River Army Depot in the 1940s.
Yeah, I remember that from your case.
Oh, yeah. We covered the Phantom Killer back in episodes 14 and 15, which feels like it was 100 years ago, honestly.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. But yeah, go check those out. Those are really good episodes.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
So Nathan was brought in for questioning and was identified as a person of interest in the case, but he denied any involvement with or knowledge of the letters. Shannon agreed to a search of their home on Maple Drive in New Boston, while Nathan agreed to allow a search of his vehicle. The FBI erected three enormous tents out in front of the home. They set up all of this equipment outside the house and deployed a team covered in full hazmat suits to begin the search, which must have made her neighbors hella nervous. Can you imagine, like, driving into your cul-de-sac or whatever and looking over and seeing something like that?
Oh, yeah. Well, I have some friends that I work with, and their neighbors have recently had the CDC show up three times.
Why?
They don't know, and they're not allowed to say. And that reminds me of this, and that's so creepy. Like, I would be freaking out.
Yeah. That's terrifying. Yeah. I don't like that at all. Keep an eye on that guy, by the way. Yeah,
is the plague starting there? The zombie apocalypse happening?
Well, what do you think they found at the Richardson residence?
I'm guessing this weird orange greasy ricin paste.
Well, they did find a lot of things. Inside the home, the team found a box containing 20 to 30 beans that were labeled as castor seeds, three or more syringes containing an unknown liquid, four or more needles, a bag containing approximately 1 teaspoon of an orange-brown unidentified substance, and a container of milky white liquid suspected of being related to the making of ricin. Many of these tested positive for ricin. In the trunk of Nathan's vehicle, the team discovered 12 small brown objects, which testing determined were also castor seeds.
He's just got them rolling around in the trunk of his car?
Yes, they were found loose in the trunk, so not in any sort of container, as if somebody had just tossed them there.
As if someone had cast them into his trunk. Is that a bad castor bean pun?
Is there a good castor bean?
I don't know. I'm trying to make one.
Oh, God.
Well, howdy, guys and gals. Here in the U.S., we just celebrated Memorial Day, and because of that, I ask you this. Can you have superior quality grooming goods for hardworking men and women? I'm here to tell you yes. Yes, you can. Are you looking for a company that partners with active duty military to develop new ideas as well as reviewing products? If you are, I'm happy to introduce you to this company. Duke Cannon is committed to giving back to the men and women serving our country. That's why a portion of their proceeds directly supports veterans' causes. That means anything that does not meet the high standards of soldiers doesn't happen as far as their company is concerned. Duke Cannon sells basically everything a tough guy or gal could ever need, such as big-ass bricks of soap, news anchor pomades, beard washes, shaving creams, and solid fragrances. Some of their featured scents are barley, sandalwood, and of course, my favorite, shea butter. I really enjoy their selection of goods, and so does Erin. She definitely noticed once I started using their hair creams, body washes, and hand creams. From one dapper gentleman to another, don't let this ad pass you by without clicking on the link in the episode's notes. Visit DukeCannon.com, that's DukeCannon.com, right now and get 15% off of your order with the promo code CATTLE. And you'll also receive free shipping on any order of $35 or more. Take it from me. You want that shea butter. All right, now back to the episode.
Well, so there are castor seeds and ricin byproducts just willy-nilly everywhere.
How did they not get ricin poisoning?
That's a really good question, actually. I don't know.
Huh.
So you might think, case closed, they've got the evidence, they've got their man, end of story. But things weren't all that simple. You see, FBI agents working with Shannon began to believe that Shannon wasn't really telling them the truth, at least not the full truth. They gave her a polygraph test, and the test showed that she was being deceptive. But of course, they didn't know exactly what that meant, if anything. After all, ricin was definitely made in that home. That was certain. But who was behind it? There were three options here. Either Nathan was behind the ricin and threatening letters alone, Shannon was behind it alone, or that they had been working together. Then, because of course the FBI was closely surveilling Shannon, they got wind of the fact that Shannon was telling friends that she was about to take her kids and go on the run.
That's a bad move if you're in this particular situation.
Exactly. So that's when the FBI decided to swoop in and arrest Shannon for being involved in the ricin-laced letters.
God, I love the FBI. They're so awesome.
She was arrested on June 7th in Mount Pleasant, Texas. Now, of course, Shannon vehemently denied that she was involved, but things began to change as her interrogation continued. Eventually, Shannon admitted that she had participated in the crime, but she insisted that she had done so at Nathan's command, that she had only complied because she was scared of him. So to make some sense out of Shannon and Nathan's relationship, let's start at the beginning when these two first met. Nathan Richardson was 28 when he first met 30-year-old Shannon Rogers. Nathan had joined the Army as a mechanic after high school and was at the time working as a civilian with the Department of Defense. The job meant that he traveled a lot, sometimes staying in exotic locations for weeks, months, or even years on end. He was on assignment in Kuwait when he first was introduced to Shannon Rogers through a coworker. The coworker happened to be related to her. Nathan and Shannon began sending emails back and forth. Shannon was a former beauty queen and a divorced mother of five sons who lived in Georgia and was trying to make it as an actress. In fact, she'd had a few bit roles in TV shows such as The Walking Dead, Drop Dead Divas, and The Vampire Diaries.
Really?
Yep, she'd even had a small role in the movie The Blind Side. While at first blush, it didn't seem like the outgoing and glamorous Shannon had much in common with the private and introverted Nathan, but soon the relationship blossomed into a long-distance romance. In early 2009, Nathan made it back home to Texas, and he and Shannon finally had a chance to meet in person. They met at a halfway point between Texas and Georgia, and were happy to see that their feelings for each other only grew after meeting in real life. Over the following months, the two would continue to drive to meet each other. He met her children and became very close to them. Nathan also learned more about Shannon's past. She told him she'd been divorced in 2004, about 5 years previously, and told him about the abuse she and her children had endured at her ex-husband's hands. Soon Shannon began talking about moving to Texas to be with Nathan, and then suddenly Shannon had a brain aneurysm. With that, Nathan decided that the best option would be to move her to Texas so he could help her with her recovery and any other health problems. So Shannon and her children moved in with Nathan in New Boston, Texas. The couple married on October 8, 2011, in a small ceremony in their backyard. But soon after they got married, things between Nathan and Shannon became rocky. Nathan noticed that Shannon became increasingly demanding and would constantly pick fights with him. Things became so bad that Nathan began considering divorce and told Shannon so. And suddenly, Shannon told him that she had been diagnosed with brain cancer. Now her behavior made sense to Nathan. Maybe this was the cause of her hostility. He wanted to be supportive of her, and he decided to stay with Shannon as a husband and a caregiver. But every time he asked her about her doctor's visits or additional information about her treatment, she wouldn't give him details. She wouldn't allow him to accompany her to the doctor and refused to even tell him her doctor's name. Her health continued to decline, and she even lost more weight, becoming painfully thin, pale, and sickly. Then in January of 2013, Shannon discovered she was pregnant. Nathan was shocked. Not only was the relationship on the rocks, but with her cancer diagnosis and her declining health, He was worried that her body couldn't handle the pregnancy, but he was intent on making things work for his growing family. That is, until something else happened a few short months later. Nathan received a phone call from a credit card company informing him that his credit card was maxed out. Concerned, he ran credit reports and ended up finding 6 additional credit cards that had been pulled out in his name that he had no knowledge of.
Uh-oh.
Nathan asked Shannon about the credit cards, but she blamed her ex-husband, saying that he must have stolen Nathan's identity. But the places where the credit cards had been used were all Shannon's favorite shops, and he knew she was lying to him.
Oh, boy.
At this point, Nathan was at his wit's end, and he could no longer put up with her lies and her manipulation. He decided that he would move forward with divorce. On May 6, 2013, Nathan met with a divorce lawyer. But in Texas, a divorce will not be granted if one of the couple is pregnant. This is true even if both parties are in agreement and both want to go through with a divorce. You can go ahead and file, but the divorce won't be finalized until after the baby is born. So Nathan kind of felt trapped in this marriage that he no longer wanted to be a part of and wasn't sure what to do. The 3 letters containing ricin sent to President Obama, Mayor Bloomberg, and Michael Glaze were mailed 2 weeks to the day after Nathan met with his divorce lawyer. 11 days after that, on the 31st, Nathan was approached at work by FBI agents regarding his role in the letters that, at this point, he knew nothing about. He was released at midnight that night after hours of questioning to find that his home was quarantined and being torn apart by FBI agents in hazmat suits, and that Shannon and the kids were gone.
Oh my gosh, poor Nathan.
Mm-hmm. And only about a week after that, Shannon was arrested. So both just before and after Shannon's arrest, investigators were continuing to collect and process evidence at the Richardson home. For example, multiple computers in the home were seized. Investigators were able to identify that purchases of castor seeds and ingredients and equipment for making ricin were made from one of the home computers. However, this discovery didn't narrow anything down necessarily. This was a shared computer. But a pink Dell laptop found in the home had been used to search for information about ricin and how to make it. They had accessed basically recipes on how to make ricin at home and information about ricin from the CDC's website. Both Nathan and Shannon agreed that this laptop was owned by and used solely by Shannon. Earlier, I mentioned a box that had been found with castor seeds and syringes inside. Well, also discovered in that box was an SD data storage card. 3 files on it matched the letters that had been sent to President Obama, Mayor Bloomberg, and Michael Glaze, and all files had been saved onto the drive from the pink Dell laptop on May 19th at 11:17 p.m.
That's pretty damning.
Mm-hmm. The files were named Obama, Muslim Bastard, and simply Guns. Each file had timestamps showing that they had been printed at 7:11 a.m. on the morning of May 20th, the day the letters had been mailed. Nathan had began a 10-hour shift at work at 6:30 that morning, and coworkers agreed that he didn't have access to any computers during that time. And that's the thing as well, that depot that he worked at is a highly restricted area. There's no way he could have snuck out and gone somewhere to print the documents.
Yeah.
So basically, he has a very airtight alibi.
Well, yeah, good for him.
Yeah. It was also discovered that a Capital One credit card opened on April 22nd had been used to make the 2 online purchases of castor seeds on April 28th and again on May 3rd, along with other supplies such as lye and syringes used in the extraction of ricin. The credit card was opened under Nathan's name as the primary account holder, with Shannon as an authorized user. Shannon's email address and cell phone were listed as the main contact for the account. The seeds were sent to a new Boston post office box that was in Shannon's name.
She seems really nefarious.
So with the preponderance of evidence, Shannon changed her story a little, wouldn't you know?
Oh, wow. Crazy that should happen.
She now admitted to receiving some of the supplies in the mail, printing the mailing labels and the letters, and putting the letters in the mail knowing that they contained ricin.
Oh, but let me guess, this was all under the direction of Nathan because she was scared.
That's right. She still claimed that Nathan was the one who wrote the letters and ordered the castor beans, and that the whole thing had been his master plan that he had forced her to be a part of.
Do you know what's really terrifying? When someone really cares about you because you've had a brain aneurysm and you have cancer and you might be pregnant with this baby that might endanger both of your lives, that is so terrifying. And just, it makes you so afraid of that person.
Oh, yeah. Like, what is this person capable of? Of course.
It sounds like Nathan is just a really nice guy that might be a little gullible.
Yeah, you're probably right about that.
Poor Nathan.
Well, after the letters were mailed, Shannon said that she, quote, took deliberate steps to ensure that he would be apprehended, including planting the castor beans in his vehicle.
Oh, did she admit to casting the castor seeds into the trunk?
You're going to go back to that well? It was dry the first time, buddy. So basically, she's like, I wasn't trying to frame him. I was trying to help you catch him. Right. I'm blameless.
Right. Yeah. There's a big difference between those two.
Yeah. So, of course, this tactic didn't really impress anyone. On June 7th, 2013, Shannon was charged with possessing and producing a biological toxin, mailing threatening communications, and making threats against the President of the United States. She agreed to a plea deal by pleading guilty to the charges, and in return, the latter two charges were dropped. So officially, she was only charged with possessing and producing a biological toxin.
What?
Shannon Guest Richardson was sentenced to 18 years in prison and ordered to pay $367,222.29 in restitution. She will not be eligible for parole until 2031, when she will be 54 years old. Nathan was cleared of any and all involvement in this plot. Nathan filed for divorce within weeks of all of this happening. Today he said that he forgives her. In the TV show, he said, quote, it's more about yourself and not the other person. They're not worth the energy it takes to hold on to. He's back to his old self now. He's happier. He said he was less like himself when he was with her in the relationship. So things are looking really good for him. Shannon's kids live with their biological fathers. Nathan was granted legal custody of their son. So she was actually pregnant. That might actually be a surprise. I was wondering if she was pregnant, you know, when I was first looking into it. She was actually pregnant. She ended up having the baby when she was in custody. The child was born several months early. So there was, you know, a bit of a health scare with the baby, but he ended up pulling through and he's doing really well now. Nathan was granted legal custody of him. So he and Nathan are living, hopefully, happily ever after.
Oh, interesting. I was wondering if there was, in fact, a baby and what happened to the baby. So that's interesting to find out.
Yeah.
She should go to prison for a much longer time.
Well, I mean, 18 years is pretty long.
Much longer. I don't care. I mean, this might be me putting on my patriotic America pants, but if you send ricin to the president and a mayor, that enough right there should be a huge time in jail.
Especially if you're trying to, like, frame somebody else for it.
And yeah, and poor Nathan.
Yeah. Well, I've got some more poor Nathan news for you.
Oh, no.
After Shannon's arrest and trial, Nathan learned that much of what Shannon had told him about her life was a complete fabrication. That divorce she'd had back in 2004 from an abusive monster who she was afraid of? Well, their divorce had only been finalized in 2011, just 18 days before she married Nathan. And it turns out that her ex-husband was just a regular guy. There was no evidence to show that he'd ever been abusive. Nathan ended up speaking to him after all of this, and he was like, yeah, he's a perfectly nice guy.
Duh.
Nathan also found out that Shannon's aneurysms and the brain cancer was also a lie. She'd most likely been starving herself and doing her makeup in a way to make her look sickly just to keep up this ruse. So basically, she was manipulating him with these fake illnesses into doing what she wanted him to do. When she decided she wanted to come move to Texas to live with him, she had the brain aneurysm.
So evil.
And he's such a nice guy that he's like, yes, please come live with me. Let's be together. I'll take care of you. When she found out that he wanted a divorce, suddenly she had the brain cancer.
Gosh, she sounds like a lunatic.
Mm-hmm. So why? Why did she do all of this? Well, some people point to the credit card fraud as Shannon's incentive to pull the wool over Nathan's eyes so completely. Feigning illnesses, obviously, helped her maintain that control over Nathan, pushing him to accept her into moving in with him and getting married, and especially so when she learned that he was considering divorce. And once she realized that he was still thinking of divorce, that's when she decided to frame him with this ricin plot. She'd get his house. She'd get notoriety for turning him in and being a victim of his. And for the first time in the life of this wannabe actress, she'd get her 15 minutes of fame, which is all she really wanted. Painting Nathan as this crazy gun nut extremist was just a way to explain why he would send ricin to these political figures.
Was Nathan that into guns at all?
It was just made up. Yeah, basically, there was no truth to it. But she knew that she had to create a reason why Nathan would be trying to kill people via this mailed poison. So, you know, making him into this secret political extremist was her solution for that. In the TV show, Who the Bleep Did I Marry? Nathan stated, I know, let's just move on from that stupid, the stupid name of that show.
The title's so dumb.
Nathan stated, quote, she wanted to make me look like some backwater, gun-toting, crazy person. And that's basically, that was her idea.
Well, I mean, it seems reasonable when you first hear about it. You're like, oh, man, just another gun nut, you know, coming after these people, political figures. Oh, I could see that. It starts to make sense. You start to build this idea in your mind of who could have sent these ricin letters.
Yeah. And then she snuck in these like tidbits. Oh, he's in the army or, you know, was in the army. You know, these little details of his life. So it makes sense. You know,
Yeah, because why would you say, oh, I'm in the army?
Exactly.
Let me tell you exactly who this person is.
But it also turns out that most likely this whole scenario wasn't something that Shannon just dreamed up on her own. You see, just months before Shannon pulled her own ricin stunt, there was another case in Mississippi where a man had mailed letters contaminated with ricin to President Obama and other politicians. What's weird is he too did it to frame somebody else and was also caught for it. And she should have known how dumb this whole idea was because the FBI uncovered that she had looked up this case as research for her own dumb ricin idea. This was part of those all of those searches about ricin and ricin related things that she had on her computer. This is one of the things that she had looked up. And she'd read up on this case and was like, yeah, that's what I'm going to go with.
What an idiot.
So stupid. And that brings us all the way back to Breaking Bad. The ricin storyline had been a major plotline in the season that had just aired before these events. And knowing how obsessed with acting and television Shannon was, it's easy to believe that the show might have also been an inspiration for her.
Oh, wow. Was she a fan? Like, was it her Netflix history?
Well,
like,
I don't know any of that specifically, but I mean, think about it. 2013 wasn't that long ago, but it was the Game of Thrones of its time. It was everywhere. Everybody was watching it.
Is it showing our age that we were so invested in Breaking Bad?
That was a good ass show.
It was the best show.
Fight anyone who said otherwise.
It was the best show.
Yeah, it had a good ending, too.
Yeah, it did.
I'm not going to say anything about that other show we just mentioned. But yeah, I mean, it was huge for its time. So was she keeping up with it? Was that something else that made her think about it? It's totally possible.
That's the only reason I knew about ricin.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, some people think that several cases involving ricin over the last few years were probably influenced by the storyline Breaking Bad, because it's been something that seems to have cropped up a lot since the whole thing that happened in Breaking Bad.
That's too bad. Like, maybe they should have changed the name of the chemical to something else, like fictitious. Like, they could have taken the idea of the research of where they got it from and just changed it up a little bit.
Meh.
Well, it's easy to say if you're not someone who's been attacked with ricin.
That's true. And I hope to never be, because it sounds really bad.
It sounds easy.
It is. I mean, that's the thing. It's very, very easy to make this and do this.
Ugh.
So please do not listen to this episode and be like, oh, that's a really great idea. Do not pull a Shannon Guest Richardson on us. Because like I said, most people are going to be caught if you do this. It's very stupid. I have no idea how she didn't kill herself, because there was ricin just everywhere.
Yeah.
What a dum-dum. You didn't even make good ricin. Like, you didn't even make something that would be inhaled instantly and kill somebody. Like, you just made some greasy mess. I think you would have had to have eaten it for anything to happen. Like, it wasn't, if it was greasy, it wasn't a powder that you can inhale. You would have it have to have ingested it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It would seem like you wouldn't want it to be anywhere close to being greasy. You want it to be like almost an aerosol or like a mist, you said, or like a very airy powder that can float through the air.
Well, that's the thing too, though. I guess we have to consider the fact that she maybe didn't necessarily want to kill anybody. She just wanted to make it look like Nathan had tried to do this to get him in jail for a very long time. So, I mean, maybe it wasn't her intent to actually hurt anybody. She just wanted Nathan to be framed for all this.
This is all real dumb.
It's very stupid. And don't do it. You got 18 years in prison. And that was on a plea deal. It could have been really worse for her. She could have actually gotten life in prison for these charges. So.
And I believe attacking a president is treason. So exactly, she could have gotten treason.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she also could have been domestic terrorism is another thing that this whole situation can be called very easily. It's just very, very dumb all around.
Yeah. What a fascinating case. And I know you cut a lot of this ricin talk and a lot of the interesting things involving the mail service out of the episode. But man, that was really interesting. I didn't know about any of this stuff.
Yeah, I would definitely go look up ricin. I mean, even the Wikipedia article is pretty interesting.
Well, go look it up and then realize you're on a ricin list somewhere.
I mean, probably. But, I mean, who's not on a list? I mean, the post office is spying on us all. I mean,
just put Breaking Bad in all of your Google searches with ricin. And
nice cover for yourself. But, yeah, all of that is really interesting. That the MICT program, really interesting. Yeah. Go look that up. And this was a really interesting case and kind of a big case. And I'm surprised that there's not even more information out there regarding it. I'm surprised it's not a big case everybody knows about just from all of these things that kind of came up because of this case.
Yeah. It makes me never want to open mail again.
I don't like opening mail. I have a thing, and I think it's just because of knowing all about true crime.
Yeah.
I don't like opening mail.
Well, and it makes you feel really concerned about people who work in the mail industry and, these jobs in Washington where you have some intern that's just opening mail for the president or some congressman or whatever. Man, what a dangerous job.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of which, back in 2001, those anthrax letters that had been sent, I believe 2 of the 5 people who died were postal workers.
Oh,
who somehow, I don't know exactly what happened, but yeah, they got exposed to the anthrax that was being sent out through the mail.
Shout out to our postal workers, man. Guys are brave soldiers.
Yeah, except for stuff flying on us. I mean, God.
Oh, yeah, that's true. But they also carry all of our Patreon rewards to all of our Patreon members. So awesome job, postal service workers.
Yeah. Well, there you go. That's the story of Shannon Guest Richardson, the TV actress turned federal prisoner.
Well, good riddance. And hopefully she doesn't get that parole. She sounds like a lunatic.
She was cray cray.
Well, is it time for something different? Is it time to move on to the next section of this show called Good News?
I'm ready for some good news. I can deal with that.
Well, I got some really cool science-y good news. If you didn't get enough science out of our ricin talk, boy, we got some marine biology coming up.
Sweet.
With a Texas twist. All right, everybody, welcome back to Good News. And this week we have an interesting story coming to you from gcaptain.com. And this is a story about an American businessman who has a particular proclivity for submarines, deep sea dives, and marine biology. Now, Aaron, I know marine biology was one of your big favorite fields of study as a child, right?
Yes.
And you always kind of fancied yourself as growing up to be a marine biologist.
Yes, that and a primatologist.
Yeah. And I think like you, as millennials, we grew up with Jacques Cousteau documentaries and watching National Geographic and dreaming of exploring the oceans and the seas. Well, this guy is a Texas businessman who's actually doing these things. His name is Victor Vescovo, and he is from Dallas, Texas. And he's got a serious passion for extreme deep oceanic exploration and a penchant for breaking records as well. So I know you're familiar with the Marianas Trench, right?
Deepest part of the ocean or something like that.
It's one of the deepest regions of any ocean in the Earth. And specifically, we're going to be looking at an area called Challenger Deep. Challenger Deep should ring a bell or two because this is the deepest part of the Marianas Trench and thought to be the deepest place on Earth. You probably have seen video on Blue Planet or Planet Earth Season 1 or 2 from the Marianas Trench, but typically those shots come from unmanned submersibles. The first ever manned dive to the bottom of Challenger Deep was actually back in 1960, and this was aboard a vessel called the Trieste. This is a U.S. Navy deep submergence bathyscape that dove to 10,912 meters below the surface of the ocean and was captained by Lieutenant Don Walsh and Swiss scientist Jacques Piccard.
Jacques Piccard?
Yeah.
Oh my.
Yeah, Jacques Piccard's father actually helped develop this submergence bathyscape submarine thing.
I was going to say, is he like a mix of Jacques Cousteau and Jean-Luc Piccard?
That's what it seems like, right? It's the perfect name for a captain of this awesome exploratory sea vessel.
Did I write this story?
I feel like it's coming out of our brains. Like, are we dreaming right now? Oh, God, we're nerds. Well, anyways, this bathyscape vehicle was basically a big tank of gasoline because it can't be compressed beyond a certain amount and it keeps the whole vessel buoyant. But the thing that they had to stay in with this was this small spherical chamber underneath this gasoline tank. And it was two dudes basically sitting as close as you possibly can with one viewport to look out of. Their descent took almost 5 hours, and the two men spent barely 20 minutes on the ocean floor before undertaking the 3-hour and 15-minute ascent back to the surface. And if you've seen pictures of the Trieste or watched the Discovery Channel documentary about their descent, you know this thing was a tiny little metal can, but this short visit was due to the terrifying concern that there was a crack in the outer window of their tiny viewport. Because of the pressure as they were going down. So they're going down. They're hearing the creaks.
Yeah.
You know, of the it sounds like a horrible nightmare, right?
Well, it sounds like all of those amazing underwater sci-fi movies that I love, like The Sphere or The Abyss.
Yeah.
Those movies are terrifying because imagine being like trapped so far underwater and then things go wrong.
Yeah, well,
I don't like it.
They got this hairline fracture in that viewport.
Mm-mm.
And they decided to keep going. That happened halfway down in their descent. And they were like, well, you know what? If we die, we die. Like, this is for science. And they went all the way to the bottom. And they were like, well, we should probably just go back up. We've seen some weird crabs eating some stuff. Let's go back to the surface. Well, their short visit was historic. But then Canadian film director James Cameron was the next to visit the bottom of Challenger Deep 52 years later in 2012. It took that long for us to get back down there. His submersible was named Deep Sea Challenger, which, lame name. Like, it's Challenger Deep, Deep Sea Challenger. Come on, James Cameron. You're a director and a writer. Let's come up with something. Well, his journey only reached the depth of 10,908 meters, falling 4 meters short of the record set by the Trieste. So he didn't even go as deep as these other guys.
I didn't even realize that. Wow. Yeah.
So that brings us to our Dallas private equity investor, Victor Vescovo. Victor, he's a badass, and is actually a retired U.S. Navy officer. And on April 28th, he made a solo dive to the bottom of the eastern pool of Challenger Deep. He reached a depth of 10,928 meters. That's 35,853 feet deep. This set a new world record for the deepest dive by a human being in the history of the world. He set another world record after he spent 4 hours exploring this basin. This is the longest period of time. Yeah, this is the longest period of time ever spent on the bottom of the ocean by a single individual. Victor actually did 5 total dives for this expedition. The previous ones were like scouting and preparation dives. And in doing so, he did multiple solo dives below what's called the Hadal Zone, which is anything that's below 6,000 meters. He is now the only person in history to ever do this.
Wow.
Yeah, so Lieutenant Walsh, the guy that we mentioned from the first expedition from 1960, he was on board Victor's dive support vessel, the Pressure Drop, which Great name for a support vessel. Come on, James Cameron. we're one upping you here. He was on board the pressure drop to witness these historic dives. So this expedition was one part deep sea exploration as well as technical proof of concept of this Triton submarine that he helped to invent, which was created as a submersible to be like the next generation of reliable transport to the bottom of the ocean for science and filmmaking. So that's really cool. And, you know, these Five Deeps Expeditions, which is the company that Victor Vescovo has helped to create, is actually filming a documentary that's going to be on the Discovery Channel that will air later in 2019. So we're going to all be able to see this and witness this Dallas businessman and U.S. Navy veteran do all these things, which I'm super excited
about.
That's
awesome. Yeah.
His next planned expedition is actually to go to Horizon Deep, which is in the Tonga Trench of the South Pacific Ocean. This is previously measured at 10,882 meters deep and widely believed to be the second deepest trench in the world. So that's exciting. So he'll have gone to both.
That's crazy. You know what? I like when Richie's are excited about science and pour their money into scientific pursuits, because a lot of times that's how we get some really cool discoveries, is when like we have people who can fund these things that otherwise governments or whatever don't want to do.
Oh yeah, if it weren't for James Cameron and Victor Vescovo, no one would have gone back there in 52 years.
Yeah, they did this for science. Like they're really hoping to really expand what we know about the sea, which is the amount that we don't know about what happens deep in the sea, especially in these really deep sections of the sea, is incredible. I mean, it's like it's like another planet down there.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, there's so much that we don't know.
Sure.
And it's incredible.
And that's the kind of the whole idea behind this Triton 36,000 LF platform, which is the submersible. Is basically over the time of this expedition, they were able to travel 68 miles of ocean depth up and down and prove that this platform was reliable and capable to be a deep sea submersible to take people all the way to the bottom of the ocean over and over and over. So it's going to become like the new yellow cab, basically, of taking you down to the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah. If it's been proven, I'll do it.
Yeah.
I don't want to be some like the first person to do anything, but I'll be like the fourth.
How cool was it that they got Lieutenant Walsh from the first expedition to be there on that support vessel? I thought that was pretty cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's like the outer space here on Earth in the bottom of the ocean.
I mean, yeah, are they going to be finding those glowing giant stingray things?
And then they're aliens
they're going to be brought to that weird underwater world. And there's going to be like the video footage of like humans destroying each other. They're going to be like, oh, this is bad.
Just talking about
the abyss.
The abyss. With Ed Harris as the main scientist.
Oh,
there.
And
will you breathe water, which apparently is a thing?
Apparently it is a thing.
Yeah.
And what's her name?
I don't know.
Mary Elizabeth Mastriantonio.
Wow. That was pulling that out of a deep cut there.
Love that name.
But yeah, that's good news.
Watch the abyss.
One step closer to being in the abyss and finding those underwater aliens.
I am ready for it.
Yeah.
We need to learn from the aliens.
They probably know more than we do.
Hopefully somebody does. Teach us what we're doing wrong before the apocalypse happens, which I'm ready for.
Well, that's an ender. All right, next up on the after show, welcome to the after show, everybody. We're going to talk about a recommendation. We've missed some recommendations in previous episodes, but we got an amazing recommendation
for
you.
It might be the best recommendation, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I'm super excited that I've even had conversations with the people of this show, and it's just an honor to call them Facebook friends and have them in my DMs. They're also going to be in Chicago with us at the True Crime Podcasting Festival. We are talking about The Fall Line. The Fall Line is a massive, really important, awesome show. And if you haven't listened to The Fall Line, you really should, because they're doing amazing work. This is an investigative narrative show that focuses on cold cases in the southeastern communities of the United States who have experienced marginalization. This is a show that is hosted by a professor and a licensed therapist. And the mission statement of The Fall Line is to give a platform to families and victims who have been passed over by the mainstream media, which is super important. And they do such an amazing job. The two hosts live and work in Atlanta, Georgia, and the show is created by Laura Norton, who, again, is going to be on some panels at the True Crime Podcasting Festival, as well as Brooke Hargrove. Laura writes, researches, and hosts the show, while Brooke does interviews and other things for the show. But man, I listened to their latest two episodes on the Jenkins County Jane Doe. They covered so many awesome topics like missing and murdered Indigenous women, Asian Pacific Islanders, and how they are often overlooked because they're involved in sex trafficking operations, and it's really hard to deal with cases that deal with those kinds of things. They do all kinds of great work for marginalized groups, and such a good investigative reporting podcast with amazing interviews.
Yeah, and they have recently moved over to the Exactly Right Network,
which is
the network that Karen and Georgia from My Favorite Murder just started. It's just such a good indicator of their success that they have moved to this network, and they're only going to get more popular and get more eyes and ears on the stories that they highlight on their show, which I think is incredibly important. I'm so happy that a show of this caliber that focuses on these types of cases has become such a big part of such a big, important network.
Yeah.
So congratulations to them. That's so cool. So they have a new season coming up. They have a bunch of episodes in their back catalog. So definitely check them out. They're so worth it. And just such a cool part of the true crime community.
Yeah, and that panel that Laura is going to be a part of is actually the line of ethics in amateur investigations as podcasters, which will be hosted by Patrick Hines, which will also be the host for my panel that I'll be on. Sorry, Nelson is making a lot of noise, but
he's excited.
He is excited.
He likes the fall line.
Yeah, but my point is, come to Chicago in July 13th. Be a part of these awesome panels. Come see Laura. Come see me. Come see Aaron. And yeah, go listen to the fall line.
Yes. And we don't have a actual promo from them. Nope. So it's just word of mouth, baby.
Yeah. Go check it out.
Just go listen.
That's it. All right. Well, now we have to make up for everything we missed out on this weird hiatus we took. We need to pay some homage, pay some respect, give the shout outs for all of our awesome patrons. And you know that means that our Texas Rangers have to get a shout out. They're always producers of every episode that we do. Thank you so much, Texas Rangers like Lisa Layton, Matthew McConnell, Steph White, Serial Killer Sweets, Michelle Guess, Andrew Margerison, Kate Williams, Mel Thomas, Don Maloney. You guys freaking rock.
That's right. And we should have another Texas Ranger sponsored episode coming up, probably as my next episode. So that's going to be the big case that one of our Texas Rangers has chosen for us to do.
Yeah.
And I'm very excited. It's a big case, and I'm excited to really get into it. So,
I'm looking forward to that one.
Oh, yeah, boy.
Well, and then, you know, we haven't gotten to our lone guns, so we're going to rattle off some lone gun names real quick. You guys freaking rock, and that's Mary Bobbitt, Moraine Murphy, Aaron Demir, Lauren, Danielle Thompson, also known as Prof. Danny, Alexandria Bergeron, Amy McMahon, Laura, Lindsay Wiggins, Geraldine Carmichael, Mary Alice Caffiero, Patricia Wilson, Diachondra Hapsari Subagayo, Stacey Wolf Wakeleitner, Karen Burrows, Pam Sullivan, Carol Baish, Alice Lynch, The Dark Poutine Podcast, Emily Blassengame, Allison Moon, Amy Derrick, Jenny Cargill, Jeremy Thomas, Sam Marshall, Ann Nunnally, Amanda Newman, Marshall Bingham, Megan Jirai, The Gone Cold Podcast, Claire Jeans, Emily Haish, and Lauren Miller. Lastly, we need to talk about our deputies. Thank you so much, deputies, for being a part of our support network. We appreciate everything that you do. Our deputies include Brittany, Amy Davidson, Cassie Collimer, Carrie Simonton, The Moms and Murder Podcast, Kathy Rambo, The Murder in My Family Podcast, Juliana Martinez, Angela Johnson, Kristen Buford, A.R. Feutzwagel, Gracie Bosch, The True Crime Fan Club Podcast, The Corpus Delicti Podcast, Megan Lundgren, Jessica M. O'Neill, Karen Parker, Marianne Connor, Kelly Roberts, Alyssa Forver, Danielle Dole, Donald Brown, The Murder and Such Podcast, Erica Kelly from Southern Fried True Crime, and that is it.
Woo!
Yeah!
Round of applause!
We did it! I think I probably only botched like three of those names. No, I feel pretty confident about the other ones.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let us know, guys, if Shay completely wrecked your name or not.
Hey, you know, before you yell at me, remember that I am dyslexic. So if you're yelling at me, you're yelling at someone with a reading disability. So just keep that in mind.
This is what Shay always goes back to.
Hey, it's a good disability to have.
Is it?
I mean, no, it's not. It's been a trial and tribulation my entire life.
Oh, my. Okay. Well, we got to get out of here. So we love you all. Thank you for listening. Hopefully this was a bit of a break. We've had such devastating cases lately, and we wanted to give you one that wasn't going to make you just sit and cry. So hopefully this was it for you. Hopefully you found it interesting.
Yeah, and also we have a new TeePublic website, so go check us out at teepublic.com. Search All Crime, No Cattle. We have some new merch over there, and we're going to be doing a bunch of new t-shirts with some artists over there. We're curating some new designs and stuff, so be on the lookout for that.
Yep.
But until next week, always remember that crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.